Надежда Толоконникова объявила голодовку.
Надежда Толоконникова сейчас в мордовской колонии.
За долгое время появилась Надежда Толоконникова, которую накануне...
Группа «Пусера» это придала заявление на волю, в котором сообщила об угрозе своей жизни. Она исходит по мнению
Толоконникова. Апелляцию участницы группы
«Пусера». Меня порадовало, что Надежда выглядит неплохо. Прям.
Slavery-like conditions. Work days that stretch from dawn until midnight. Sleep deprivation, beatings, torture, and even death threats. These are some of the conditions that prisoners in penal colony number 14 in Russia's Republic of Mordovia are enduring, according to an open letter jailed Pussy Riot member Nadezhda Tolokonnikova sent to Russia's Human Rights Ombudsman this week. Tolokonnikova also announced she was starting a hunger strike and has been placed in solitary confinement. Tolokonnikova, of course, is serving a 2-year prison sentence in the penal colony for participating in a punk prayer in Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral, in which she and other members of the feminist punk rock collective called on the Virgin Mary to rid Russia of Vladimir Putin. She and fellow Pussy Riot member Maria Alyokhina are due to be released in March 2014. Letters from prison have a long history of carrying emotional power and moral weight in Russia. Will Tolokonnikova's appeal continue this tradition? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine, Ne Prekrasnyeveni Zapas. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean. It's good to see you again.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
As this story developed last week, I found the reaction to it even more interesting than the letter itself. And to get the ball rolling, I wanted to read a quote from the blog of Archdeacon Andrei Kuraev, a leading figure in the Russian Orthodox Church. Kuraev was writing in response to those who had criticized Tolokonnikova on social networks, and this is what he had to say. The exasperation of ostensible Christians over this prison letter looks strange. The letter's message is not about some special suffering experienced by the author, but about the suffering of thousands of other jailed women. It's a human being's protest caused by pain and humiliation. As for my own personal attitude to the author, I will put it this way. Tolokonnikova's life before the arrest looked very disgusting to me. Her behavior after it appears decent. And then there was this from the pro-Kremlin daily Izvestia. Tolokonnikova's message is not about her personal fate, but about the appalling conditions at the penitentiary for the other women. And in response to critical comments about Tolokonnikova's letter on social networks, Izvestia had this to say. All this was written on Facebook by people at least with higher education and having high salary jobs. Tolokonnikova's letter is about the hundreds of women being subject to torture and humiliation at a time when well-educated and successful men are putting "it serves them right" messages. One 23-year-old jailed woman stands up instead of all these men and gets into the line of fire. A headline in the liberal online magazine Slon asked the pointed question, can Tolokonnikova shake up the gulag and the Russian Orthodox Church at the same time? Kirill, your thoughts. Something interesting appears to be going on here.
I'll begin with, sort of metaphorical or even maybe, symbolical consideration that Tolokonnikova or Pussy Riot case is a sort of aleph of Russian society and Russian politics. It's a very small case, but inside of this, we can see, numbers and numbers of problems of Russian society and Russian state, either political, moral, even theological, and so on. And when we try to analyze the situation, I'd like to propose, to do this on the various levels of, thinking and consideration. First of all, Who are those people who are speaking about Lakonnikova as, you know, you brought them, drew them and as an example of various, you know, opinions on pro-Kremlin or pro-Russian Orthodox side? First of all, Andrei Kuraev and his vis-a-vis, you didn't mention him, Vsevolod Chaplin, who spoke extremely against Tlakonnikova.
Yes, Chaplin had a very different opinion, yeah.
Yes, for me, they played, you know, the roles of, they play the roles of good cop and bad cop in the Russian Orthodox Church, in the ideological field of a Russian Orthodox Church. Andrei Kuraev tries to be a symbol of a common sense in Russian Orthodox Church, of Russian Orthodox Church. It's not a very easy task, you know. But anyway, he tries desperately to do this, to be, you know, at the same time a sort of Protestant theologian.
Or at least a Jesuit.
Yes, and at the same time to be Gilbert Keith Chesterton from the common sense, of the common sense, you know, theological common sense and so on. At the same time, Vsevolod Chaplin tries to play, you know, a servant of an Old Testament God. Yes, who is, you know, not kind, not Jesus Christ, who, you know, loves everyone and so on. But it's just a game. It's just a game.
Is it a game? You think this is all staged, that from these two very different opinions? Because I was surprised to see anybody from the Orthodox Church expressing sympathy for Tlakonnikova in this situation. Even Kuraev.
No. If you look at the, you know, behavior, some, you know, statements and gestures of Kuraev, you'll see, you know, a quite long history of his remarks about this case and so on. It's not his first, you know, appearance as a defender of common sense and, you know, some human values, humanitarian values and so on. He is trying to make Russian Orthodox hierarchy not so, you know, brutal, not so violent, not so, you know, unliberal in some way.
So you're saying this is all Pakazuka to a degree?
In some sense, yes. Another case is Izvestia.
Now, Izvestia, that threw me for a loop when I read that.
It's very interesting because on the one hand,
because there's nothing closer to a Kremlin mouthpiece other than Channel One than Izvestia.
Yes, but don't forget that Izvestia tries to be, you know, sort of respectable, pro-official media institution. It's not like, you know, Moskovsky Komsomolets or something like this, yes? It's not online magazine Vzgliad and something like this. It tries to draw attention and sympathy from the, you know, sort of... I don't know if it exists really, from the middle class, which could support Putin. And of course, their approach to the Pussy Riot case and Tlakonnikova letter and so on of this middle class is, you know, divided very deeply and strongly. So they try to be more human. So my resolution is that moderate Putinists, moderate, you know, Orthodox clergy, try to look more human in this case.
So it's Pakazuka to what end? Let's bring Sean in here. Sean, what are your thoughts on this? What do you see happening here?
Well, it was an incredibly powerful letter.
Yeah,
and Tlakonnikova, I mean, she really is, in all of her kind of statements that have come from prison, it's incredible how she really is becoming, you know, the conscience of the Russian nation. She's an incredibly powerful figure. A couple of things. I don't agree with Kirill in terms of the Orthodox Church, because I think we have to remember that there are many views within the church. You have more liberal views, you have more kind of socially conscious views, and you have more fundamentalist and conservative views. And from the beginning, the church seemed to be split on what to do with Putsi Riot. I mean, there were hard line views. Chaplin is a good example of this. And you had softer line views on how they should be approached. They were kind of united in condemning the act, but what to do with Pussy Riot was a different story, and there are many views from the beginning on this in the church. And I think it's important to remember that the church itself does not have a unified voice. Izvestia is quite interesting. I mean, Maxim Kononenko, who is no liberal himself, very conservative,
right,
wrote a column on this letter saying that he was ashamed to be Russian. I mean, to make him ashamed to be Russian is, I think, a really powerful statement. And I would submit that I think we have to keep in mind the gender dynamics of this.
Yes.
You know, the quote that you read from Izvestia pointed to the fact that here you have women who are in these horrible conditions. And it's a woman who's standing up and speaking about this, about all, you know, standing up to men. And I think the fact that Tony Kolomenko is a woman speaks is far more powerful. If a man would have written this letter, it would have been dismissed out hand.
Right. I mean, Hodorkovsky could have written this letter and it would not have had this kind of resonance. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think for Russian conservatives, this, I think, speaks to their own idea of women need to be protected. Women are somehow need to be are pure. And Tony Kolomenko's letter really points to the fact that, you know, these women are being completely mistreated and abused and taken advantage of. I mean, so I think that that speaks to this kind of masculinity of Russian conservatism to some extent.
Now, there's something else I wanted to get at here, and you're both historians, and I think you can both speak to this pretty eloquently. Prison letters, as I said in the intro, have this amazing power in Russia that they don't seem to have elsewhere. And a lot of this, I think, is because, like, a lot of people see prison as some kind of metaphor for Russia in a lot of ways. I mean, Pavel Durev, is he still the CEO of Kontakte, but the founder of Kontakte, said, you know, any one of us could be in this young woman's position. You know, so we are all Tolokonikova. Why do you see the prison letters having such resonance in Russia? Why is this the case?
Well, first of all, there is a very long tradition in Russian culture. Yes, it began from famous Dostoevsky book, Записки из мертвого дома. So, first of all, and everyone, you know, every who was in Soviet or Russian school, you know, knows about this book and hopefully read just an extract from it. But anyway, secondly, of course, this huge figure, personality of Alexander Solzhenitsyn with his archipelago Gulag and so on. Thirdly, Russian population as a whole has very intensive, strong prison experience, because if you will see a number of, you know, Russian citizens who came, who went through the prison colonies and so on, so penal colonies, so you will see that, I don't know the numbers, the exact numbers, but I think that from 5 to 10% of Russian population, you know, has this experience. That's my third point. And the fourth point is, it's very important, the most important thing when we're speaking about Tolokonnikova case and so. And Alekhine, don't forget about Alekhine, who is fighting, you know, desperately against these conditions in her colony and just, you know, had canceled court in Nizhny Mayne.
Yeah, she had a hearing yesterday, yeah.
And the point is that Tolokonnikova doesn't appeal to liberal part of the society. She appeals to the whole Russian population for the very human nature of everyone. And that is very important. That's not about politics. It's not about, you know, market economy or some, you know, freedom of press or something like this. It's about the conditions, the very conditions of human being.
This goes to something very, very fundamental. And this is like the metaphor of Russia as prison, I think, is powerful here. And Sean, why is that? What do you think? Why does that metaphor have such resonance, to think of your own country that you express to be patriotic about, but yet this prison metaphor is at the same time so powerful?
Well, I think it's because of what Kuriel just laid out. I mean, the long tradition of literature, also the extolling of the prisoner as kind of a pure person, the people who survive and go through, right? The people like Solzhenitsyn, who wrote these eloquent, very descriptive and horrifying tales of the prison experience. I mean, these figures seem to be exceptional, and they are exceptional, but they're exceptional within the Russian system because they really face the bare nakedness of the state. And that bare communicates to a lot of people's feelings that they are actually colonized people by a Russian state within their own country, by a kind of alien force that's oppressing them. And the prison experience is the most kind of harshest, bare life experience you have with that state. And you can, and you see this in her letter. I mean, the really striking, you know, the prison official saying that, you know, in terms of politics, he's a Stalinist. I mean, this evokes so many images. The fact that she claims that he threatened her life, the sheer kind of helplessness that that the women in her camp. And I think this is important too about her letter. It's not about her.
Yeah, that was.
It's about all of the women in the camp with her. And I think that has a really powerful signal that the fact that she didn't put herself center stage speaks to a much more general experience.
Well, yeah.
I have to, one more link. That said, though, despite the historical and the cultural resonance of the prison experience in Russian society and some of the attachment that people might feel with it, nonetheless, Russian prisons remain horrible, horrible places.
Right.
And prison reform is not forthcoming on the minds of the Russian population. I mean, in a lot of – there's also a streak, a very – and you see this in some of the comments about her letter of what does she expect? A streak of people – criminals need to be punished. I mean, look at the statistics on in Russian society that want the reinstatement of the death penalty.
Right. You touched on something I think very important here. You said the word purifying function of prison, and that was actually one of the things I wanted to touch upon. And you can't, I mean, in recent history, you can't avoid remembering Hodorkovsky, who went to prison as a very unsympathetic figure in the eyes of most Russians, and who has undergone this metamorphosis in prison into this. I mean, you almost expect him when he finally gets out to have a halo on his head.
And well, the Bolsheviks had this idea, too, that the prison was a kind of it made you a hard. This is what transformed you into a pure revolutionary. If you were a Bolshevik who didn't have prison experience, you weren't much of anything in the first old Bolshevik generation. So I think that this. And also for the Russian revolutionaries and intelligentsia of the middle and late Tsarist period too, the prison was this kind of pure – it made you a more pure moral person to go through this system. It made you stand above and your voice was far clearer and far more important in society. And I think that that tradition has gone down. And you're right about Hodorkovsky. I mean, before Hodorkovsky went to prison, he was hardly considered a saint.
Right.
And now this is all you hear about is his sainthood and not really about what he did before he was
right.
Arrested.
No, that's amazingly been airbrushed from a lot of people's collective memories. So what do we think? Has Konikova just gone through a metamorphosis? I mean, has she just had her baptism of fire? Is this letter going to change how she's viewed in the society? Either of you jump in, Kirill or Sean. I'm curious to hear what you think about this. I'm not sure what I think yet.
Just one, you know, very quick consideration. It's very interesting that the most powerful political and from the moral point of view figures in modern Russian society, modern Russian, you know, politics in prison now. That's very interesting. Hodorkovsky is in prison. Tolokonnikova and Alekhina, they are in prison. Navalny could be in prison, you know, in several weeks.
Yeah, he could be, and it's very interesting whether he will be or not.
Yes, but it's another question. But the point is that it's a very strange sort of society where all moral authorities, if you like it, are in prison at the same time.
Well, it's very interesting that you just put Tolokonnikova together with Navalny and with Hodorkovsky. I mean, are we seeing the birth of another opposition star here in many ways? I mean, she is amazingly articulate. She is undoubtedly extremely intelligent. God, I mean, are they writing her biography for her, too?
I'm not speaking about just Tolokonnikova. Don't forget about Alekhina.
No, we, of course, do not forget about Alekhina.
It's very important. There is a huge difference between them. Hodorkovsky is an iconic figure for liberal Russia. Navalny, you know, we discussed a lot of times about him. Yes, his figure and so on. And everyone knows who is Navalny now in, you know, public opinion. And I can feel, you know, a lack of, in this system, a lack of powerful, just public figures, moral examples. in some sense. It's very strange that two young women who participated in such indecency, yeah, in some sense, mm-hmm. are becoming sort of moral examples for all the society. Yeah. That's very interesting. It speaks a lot, not just about these two brave and intelligent and so on young women. It speaks a lot about Russian society today.
Mm. And I would say in terms of the indecency, I mean, essentially what they did to get these 2-year sentences was lip sync and play air guitar for approximately 30 seconds.
I'm not speaking from my point of view. I'm speaking from the, you know, public point of view.
Right. No, I
know. So I am a great fan of punk rock.
We are all great fans of punk rock. But going back to where we started, the reaction that we've seen in the church and the reaction we've seen from the Kremlin mouthpiece Izvestia, albeit, as Kirill points out, an intelligent Kremlin mouthpiece. Do you think this signifies something larger politically?
That's really hard to say. I mean, I think we're going through the period first of shock. Mm. Right. You know, to actually, you know, it's amazing that this would even shock people.
Yeah, I know, but it did.
The conditions considering what conditions in Russian prisons have been like for a long time, it's interesting that it shocked people. But again, I think the gender component of this is part of that shock.
Yeah.
Now, whether it will result in any long-term discussion, will it survive the media news cycle? I think a lot of this depends on Toni Kolnikova herself and the fact that she keeps on speaking out and keeping this alive.
Every time she speaks out, she does so very eloquently.
Absolutely, and she gets a lot of attention for it. But one of the things I want to say, both Alokhina and Toni Kolnikova have proven that, I mean, really their act as Pussy Riot has been now made insignificant. These two women are the real deal in terms of revolution. They aren't like Navalny and they aren't like Khodorkovsky in any way, because they like in the tradition of Russian revolutionaries of the past, they live the revolution. You know, them as prisoners have shed more light on the Russian system than anything they've done previously. And they've become an incredibly powerful voice for, I mean, Alokhina, and the fact that she's standing up in all of her hearings and demanding that her rights be respected and that the court go by procedure. You know, she's channeling, I think, frustrations that many Russians feel toward, say, the court system or the state or the bureaucracy. And I think they're both incredibly powerful voices. And, you know, the state has not crushed them.
Right.
Right. One could have expected that they were put in these horrible prisons and we never would hear about them again until they came out, you know, because they wanted to keep their mouths shut and get out of prison in due time, maybe earlier or something. But they haven't done that.
Yeah.
And I think it sends a really powerful message to many Russians that, yeah, they may not agree with what they did in Christ Our Savior Cathedral, but they certainly can sympathize with the power of their voice and connect to it in some way.
Yeah, no, and I go back to Durev's comment. Any of us could be in this young woman's position, and I thought that was an incredibly powerful statement. Another thing I would add also is, you know, Telekonikov is 23, Alyokhin is 25. These are two women who were born in the Soviet Union, but were toddlers when it broke up, and who have no recollection of the Soviet experience. They are the first post-Soviet generation, and I think that has a lot to do with the way they are approaching this. And I don't think the Russian state has never faced an opponent of this generation of this type yet, and I think that's showing a lot. In a few moments, we're going to broaden the aperture a bit and take a look at whether the Kremlin, after cracking down on dissent for months, is maybe considering loosening the screws. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine Ne Prekrasnoveni Zapas. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
I would not exclude an amnesty. but this case must be taken very seriously. I don't exclude an amnesty, but we must allow the necessary procedures to reach their logical, legal end.
During his meeting with opposition figures this week at the Valdai discussion forum last week, Vladimir Putin said he would not rule out an amnesty for the defendants in the so-called Bolotnaya case against 27 people charged with inciting mass unrest during protests in Moscow in May of 2012. Putin's comments came in response to a question from opposition figure Vladimir Ryshkov, who later wrote that Putin's open-ended answer, which we just listened to, left him enough maneuvering room to pursue any course he chooses. But at least he acknowledges the existence of the problem and agreed that we should continue the discussion. I wouldn't have really paid much attention to this, except for what happened a couple of days later. Pavel Krasheninnikov, a leading United Russian member who chairs the State Duma's legislative committee, said he agreed with the idea of an amnesty, adding that lawmakers could consider such a proposal as early as next month. This all comes amid renewed discussions about introducing greater pluralism into the political system yet again, this time in the wake of the September 8th regional elections. So here we have talk of an amnesty in one of the most politicized cases in Russia, and we have, again, talk of greater pluralism in the political system. And when we add this all on to what we were talking about in the first half of the podcast, about the Telekonikova letter and how it resonated and the reaction it got even in the pro-Kremlin media, I don't dare call this a thaw. I will not use that word. But Sean, is something happening here, even if what it is ain't exactly clear?
You know, it's interesting that Sergei Guriev gave an interview to Reuters Russia earlier this week, and he called it a thaw.
Yeah.
Which was really surprising. I found that surprising. He felt that the Moscow elections and mostly the downturning of the economy would signal a kind of relaxation. The fact that the opposition showed that it had, at least Navalny showed it, he had some a constituency within Moscow. He was generally popular. And the fact that they opened up the system to more competition in the elections. But mostly he pointed to the worsening economic system as reason for a kind of thawing of politics within Russia. Now, whether he's correct or not, who knows? But it's interesting that he, who is in exile in France, is the one who suggested that a thaw is upon Russian politics. That said, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we can't really take one statement by Putin and extrapolate it, especially since, as Ryshkov pointed out, he left it completely open-ended. Yeah, he doesn't exclude the idea of an amnesty, but he doesn't include it either.
But if you have a leading member of United Russia who chairs the legislative committee in the Duma saying, I want to take this up legislatively, that tells me this thing might have some legs.
Right, but we'll see where – I mean, I'm incredibly pessimistic, so I let's see if it goes anywhere. And it is interesting, you're right, to point out that, you know, you do have a high Duma member putting forward the idea that the Bolotnaya 26, I think it is, can be amnestied. But, you know, this again opens up and also this – I would say this about the Navalny, if Navalny is going to go to prison or not. You know, this opens up a big problem. In the fact that, or especially around Bolotnaya, the Russian government has made it out to be a vast conspiracy,
right,
funded by, you know, money from abroad. They've turned it into a giant show trial on this fact. And now if they turn around and amnesty all these people, then what are these charges? The same with Navalny. If they don't put Navalny in prison, then what were all of these charges? It just further proves that all of these were politically motivated. And so the question is, how will they handle that, if at all?
This is an example of how collectively brilliant we are. I should say with my tongue in my cheek, because if you remember months back, we had a podcast about these show trials. And Sean, I think it was you that we were saying these show trials are shows for the defendants, not for the state anymore. And they're going to our collective opinion at the time, if I remember correctly, was that these things are going to backfire on the state. And they are. It already has in the Navalny case. And it seems to be doing so in the Bolotnaya case. And it seems to be doing so in the Pussy Riot case, which makes you wonder what's going on in the Kremlin right now. You don't hear the hardline statements you were hearing just months ago. Surkov's back.
Yeah.
Right? Now, what that means, I don't know. He's going to oversee, what is it, relations with Georgia, or relations with the
Ossetia.
With Ossetia in Abkhazia, which means by definition he'd be, have to be dealing with relations with Georgia. Volodin is talking like Surkov circa 2010. He's talking about bringing managed pluralism into the system. Now, if you remember correctly, late in the Medvedev presidency, Surkov was arguing this and Volodin was arguing the exact opposite, and Volodin won that argument, but now it looks like Surkov won that argument because managed pluralism seems to be in vogue again.
Well, maybe Guriev is right. Maybe the economy really does scare them, and yeah, that they're letting some steam out of the boiling pot so as to not to kind of blow up worse than it is, because I think we also have to remember that for the most part, the Russian opposition has been a political opposition.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been a social opposition. And I think it, from all of the kind of buzz in the media that you see or see periodically, the one thing that the Kremlin fears the most is a social opposition that calls into question the social economic conditions of the Russia. And you see some peaks of this. The protests around the reforms of Iran is a good of the Academy of Sciences is a good example of this. This is a constituency that's really I saw an article on Sloan that made reference to it in reference to the protests against the monetarization of benefits in 2005. Because this is a constituency
which terrified the Kremlin.
Exactly. Because this is the Academy of Sciences is a constituency that is essentially should be pro-government, right? They're Buzhetniki.
Right.
And if they're flaring up and complaining and taking to the streets, I think this sends a signal to the Kremlin that maybe they need to somehow let some steam out.
Well, yeah, and this – I mean the social protests obviously terrify them because they've lost the middle class and they've staked their whole existence on the working class and rural poor. And if the economy tanks, they're in trouble. We've said this – I mean we're like the boys who collectively cry wolf on this because I've been expecting the economy to worsen for a while and it hasn't yet. But several serious economists are saying trouble is right around the corner. We'll see. Kirill, what are your thoughts on this? Are we seeing a thought? I mean, last week, Nina Khrushcheva took issue with my use of the word thaw to describe the Medvedev presidency. She'll be on the podcast again next week. I am certain she will have a problem with us using that word to describe what's going on right now under Putin. But Kirill, what are your thoughts on this?
First of all, don't be scared.
I'm not scared, I'm just pointing it out.
Secondly, I think Sergei Guriev took Indian summer in Paris for thaw in frozen Putin's Russia. He lives in Paris, as far as
yes,
I know.
Yes, he does live in Paris.
Of course, it's not thaw. I'm very pessimistic about the changing of the nature of Putin's regime. Not because they're, you know, so evil, all these people and so on. No, they're cynical but not evil in some sense. But this regime couldn't change, cannot change.
Because if it changes, it will change.
Yes, yes.
in a different way.
It can exist just in one form.
If this regime changes, we'll have regime change.
In the recent form. But they play with the idea of some other, you know, more human, as we discussed in the first part of the podcast, to obtain a more human, you know, face, a more human image. And they try to do this because of, and then absolutely agree with Sean, because of, first of all, we don't know the exact, situation, the real situation, the Russian economy. But I think all these people, they feel something about serious economical...
There's anxiety out
there,
for sure.
Yes, yes. We don't know. No one knows, I think, outside, you know, special committees or something like this. But anyway, that is the feeling that they got several months ago, and we can see the consequences of this. Secondly, Putin's regime has to go on somehow, politically and ideologically, not just with the help of this stupid conservatism and, you know, neo-Slavophile rubbish and so on. They have to seek the support of, a serious part, economically and politically serious part of Russian population somehow. And they can do this with all these, you know, speeches about, you know, traditional values and so on, speaking at the same time that we against, you know, homosexuality. But I, you know, personally, as Putin told, I adore, you know, type of behavior which Berlusconi used to show to the outer world. So if this is a traditional value of Russian society, so I can, you know, very, you know, I must be very doubtful about the future of this sort of conservative ideology. So anyway, I think they think about the necessity to have two foots. One foot is, you know, traditional or traditionalist, conservative, and so on. At the same time, another foot is, you know, in some sort liberal,
right?
In some sort, you know, human. So it's like, you know, we have, say, Rogozin, and at the same time we have, you know, Kapkov in Moscow.
Right. Kirill, I think you touch on something real important here. As you say, this regime can't change, because if it does, we'll have regime change. I think you touch on something really important, because what do we have now? We do have Volodin talking like Surkov circa 2010. We have Prokhorov's article in Vedomosti arguing that Russia needs to move to this kind of pluralistic multi-party or two-party system, as he puts it. We're seeing some signs that the crackdown is easing, but you have to wonder if, you know, po is dujou shol, you know, it's all over. They could have done this back in 2011. They could have done this if they continued the Medvedev presidency, continued what I deemed the Medvedev thaw once. They might have been able to get away with this, but now I think it's too late, no? Sean, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think we all agree, they completely miscalculated in 2011.
But is it too late now? Can they try that again, or has the train really left the station on that?
I'm not sure. I mean, it depends. You know, Pavlovsky gave an interview to Sloan this past week, basically saying that the Valdai conference, with the inclusion of Ryzhkov and Sobchak and Ponomarev to ask Putin questions, was kind of like a signal saying, you know, we're not afraid of you anymore. We beat you.
Mm.
And perhaps they're thinking that, yeah, we understand that you have a constituent. And Putin's speech had a lot of this kind of conciliatory in moments in it. At one point, he said, you know, in his discussion of the Russia needing a national identity, he said, you know, all of us neo-Slavophiles, neo-Westerners, liberals, statists, we need to learn how to talk to one another, right? And he seemed to try to include, he said, the one thing that should bind us all essentially is patriotism. As long as you're a patriot, and what he means by that, who knows,
right.
But, you know, he seemed to try to bring the liberal wing into the conversation, at least make a gesture to it, to figure out that Russia needs kind of a larger identity to drive it forward, and we shouldn't be, you know, he made this one comment about how those who've been, a lot of times those who've been against the government are actually those against Russia. And we saw this in the revolutionary movement in the past, and the destruction of the Tsarist state and the destruction of the Soviet state. So he seems to have these kind of moments where he's trying to include other people outside the system within it to be a part of it. But who knows how that will pan out over the coming months and the coming years. So yeah, I don't know if they can. I think they can actually save things a bit. It's just, you know, the problem is I'm sure in their minds, if they open this, let too much steam out, it will all kind of start to crumble.
Right. No, I think that's a distinct possibility, and certainly I'm sure that's what the Siloviki are arguing. I'm sure that's what Sergei Ivanov is arguing. But Volodin's a pretty good barometer on this, and we see where he is right now. He seemed to be more along the Siloviki line earlier in his tenure, and he seems to be moving closer to the technocratic side of things now. Again, I go back to Prokhorov's article in Vedomosti, where he was arguing this need for this two-party system. Presumably he was thinking his party, and you know, he's still untested as a politician, I'm sure. I mean, I really, his performance in the presidential elections notwithstanding, and some new configuration of United Russia. But then you got, you know, the big variable in this whole thing, and I think it's going to be a big tell about where this is going to go, is the Navalny question.
One other comment. I mean, I think we have to remember that Russian politics seems to work on two levels. Mm-hmm. There's the level of below, and there's a level amongst the elite above. And Putin has always been one who tries to balance forces at the top. Mm-hmm. And it could be that because of the overwhelming, you know, presence of the Siloviki faction, if we call it that, over the last 2 years, perhaps now he's trying to balance them back and bring in, you know, to kind of whittle away their influence a bit by trying to relax things. But that's complete
perhaps
speculation.
He's trying to return to his old role as the indispensable man, the indispensable broker. I'm just wondering if he hasn't lost that role already in the elite, because I don't think anybody trusts him to be an honest broker anymore, because he seems to have thrown his lot so much in with the Siloviki after first returning to the Kremlin. I think a big tell, of course, is going to be what happens with Navalny. Do they put him away or not? Because we're going to find that out in a couple of weeks, probably. And then B, what is, because it's been really quiet on the Navalny front for a couple of weeks. And one has to wonder what's going on in these negotiations that we thought were going on between Navalny. He seemed to have an entree into the system. And what was he going to do with that? Mark Eliade, I thought, put it perfectly. He can be either an insurgent or he can be a midwife. He can try to get in and change it from within. What do you see happening there? What kind of signs are you guys looking for there? Because I'm really curious watching this, where this is going. And it's been very quiet on that front lately.
It's very funny that we are speaking about Putin as a broker in his previous part of his, you know, presidency and so on. And now the very role of being broker is changed. So can you imagine Putin who is broker between Sechin and Navalny?
No, Kirill, that's a very important point because, as Sean pointed out, and we've all watched throughout the entire Putin period, Putin has been the indispensable broker up top. But there's a new player in the game now called the Russian Street.
Yes.
And that street has a very skilled and powerful representative called Alexei Navalny. And I don't know if Putin could be a broker between Navalny and Sechin or Ivanov and Navalny. No way. And that's what I mean. And we keep going back to this. If this regime changes, we're probably going to see regime change, which is why we don't see this regime change. Right.
I think the key player in this new situation is Russian society itself, and the most active part of this society, not just creative class and so on, but just middle class, if you can, you know, call it this part of population in such terms, and especially provincial businessmen. Mm-hmm. I think that is the very important thing, because we discussed a lot of time that protest couldn't be just Moscow, right. In Moscow, yes, a Moscow thing, yeah, or St. Petersburg thing. It must be a public social movement, must be, you know, popular in the very meaning of this word. That means that, how can I say it? So I'm not speaking about, you know, a huge revolution and so on, but public support for such figures, as Navalny, as
Roisman,
we told, you know, yes, and so on. That is the most important thing, and that is the most, you know, fearful thing for Putin and his regime. I'm not speaking about, of course, not speaking about, you know, so-called democratic revolution, or democratic movement, and so on, because Russian society isn't, you know, the very idea of democracy and liberal values are not such, you know, popular in Russian society, not such popular, but to be against Putin and to be liberal, now this is two different things.
Or they're not, well, they're not necessarily the same thing,
yes,
is how I would
yes,
put it.
Yes,
but
maybe.
Summing up, what I kind of see now is I see the regime wobbling on a couple of fronts. I mean, they're wobbling on things, as Sean pointed out, on the Bolotna case and the Navalny case and on the Pussy Riot case, that if we do have an amnesty, like Sean pointed out, then what was this vast conspiracy you were all talking about to begin with? if Navalny gets off, what was this big criminal case you fabricated that whole thing? They're going to discredit themselves on that front. On the political pluralism front, they lit a little air in the system, the whole thing might collapse. That's, there is a threat of that. But if they don't, they're having enormous pressure from the street. So I see it wobbly on a couple of fronts. But and Kirill, I think you're right. The Russian society, in the active part of Russian society, is the key variable right now. Before we wrap up, last word to each of you. Anything we want to add here?
Two things. First off, you know, Putin has in the Valdai thing, he gave several signals. The question, I guess, is now do his signals matter? Right. Mm-hmm. If he like, for example, a couple of days ago, in terms of this Greenpeace protest in the Arctic, he said, you know, of course these people aren't pirates. Yet the investigative committee seems to continue to possibly prosecute them for piracy. So
right.
I guess we have to wonder, you know, how much. You know, Russia is always a place of kind of informal politics and personal connections. And the question is, do these signals from Putin still matter? And I think we have to wait and see about that. In terms of pluralism, you know, I think Kirill is right. I mean, we shouldn't assume that more pluralism equals more liberalism. In mm-hmm. fact, it seems that more pluralism has equaled less liberalism mm-hmm. because what is allowed, and if you look at the party landscape, for Russia, for the most part, you have very illiberal parties participating, new parties participating in the system. And it's possible, and this is just a wild theory, that more pluralism in the Russian political system will make Putin look more sane.
Right. We've talked about that, God, way back in the end of 2011 when we might be, you know, if, depending on how this thing turns out, we might be pining for the liberal days of Putin, as crazy as that might sound right now. Kirill, any last thoughts from you?
My prediction is that they definitely send Navalny to prison in 2 weeks. And the situation in the country will be very tense in the end of this year. Not just social or political situation, but economic situation. Because I can imagine that something really still exists, some threat to the economic stability in Russia. And Putin and his ministers and so on, they understand this threat, but they can't do anything with this because the instrument or tools to change the situation, they are not economical, but they are political. But they can't use these instruments or tools no more.
So you've returned to form, Kirill. Last week, you nearly made me pass out in the studio with an optimistic comment closing out the podcast. I'm glad to see you're back to your old self again. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine, Ne Prekrasnoveni Zapas. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and superhumanly patient producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.